The reason for this unawareness of the frightening danger to our country and to the entire free world is simple. The masterminds behind this great conspiracy have absolute control of all of our mass communications media, especially television, the radio, the press, and Hollywood. They have the right and the power to manage the news, to tell us not the truth, but what they want us to believe. They have seized that power on orders from their masters of the great conspiracy.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's online politics show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the second hour, US fighters buzz an Iranian airliner over Syria. Illegal US presence in Syria? What are they doing there, these planes? They also caused injuries on board. And also China must retaliate, apparently, after the US closes the Houston consulate. And Pompeo, the US Secretary of State, says the US will no longer tolerate China. What does he mean by that, no longer tolerating China? I'm afraid you're going to have to, Pompeo. Goldman Sachs also pays $4 billion today in compensation over the 1MDB scandal in Singapore. It wrestles back control of its state in Singapore from the international Bilderberg banksters. And also, was lingerie chain Victoria's Secret owner Les Wexner the Epstein and Maxwell money man? That's what one of Maxwell and Epstein's cool girls, Maria Farmer, believes. And she's in conversation tonight here with Chile-based US journalist Whitney Webb. So, what was really poisoned in Salisbury? Was it the Skripals or was it US-UK-Russia relations? Those bungling Russians in Salisbury and the Skripal affair were the reason Theresa May's government passed the UK version of the 2012 US Magnitsky Act in May 2018. This allows UK authorities to name any person at any time with no appeal and no questions as a human rights abuser and money launderer. Wherever they are in the world, their UK assets are frozen and their visas are rescinded. So, first tonight, why the Salisbury story can't possibly be true. And a pandemic to cover the bailout. His website is thirdalliance.ch. His book, Grand Deception, The Truth About Bill Browder, The Magnitsky Act and Anti-Russia Sanctions. That was published in 2018. And that is Alex Craner. We'll be hearing from him in the second hour after 6 o'clock. But joining me to review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello.
And we're in actually back in a studio for the first time since the pandemic started, aren't we, rather than sitting at home with our dodgy mics.
Indeed.
So first, what, is there anything you'd like to draw attention to this week? Particularly, I think the Labour Party has been going through a few problems, hasn't it? Particularly with Keir Starmer. And the new regime starting to turn its guns on Corbyn, and included in that is the BBC Panorama editor, managing editor, I think he is now, John Ware.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, Starmer has been asserting his authority this week in various ways. They decided to settle out of court, the Labour Party, with the various former employees who claim to be whistleblowers exposing anti-Semitism in the party. According to Jeremy Corbyn, the party's legal advisers were pretty certain that they could win any libel action that they took against the party. But Keir Starmer has decided to give them a massive chunk, we don't exactly know how much, of Labour Party funds and an apology. But of course what Corbyn has done, piping up from the back, is to say that he's not very happy with that decision. And, of course, then John Ware, who's the Panorama producer, has now threatened to sue Corbyn. And Corbyn basically has raised $100,000 in the last 24 hours for a court case. Oh. So if Keir Starmer thought he was going to make this all go away by paying these people off, it's rather backfired.
And if it does backfire, this could be really problematic for the Labour Party. It'd be absolute turmoil over the next few months as the various factions are infighting instead of fighting the Tories.
Yes, it's very unfortunate, and in many ways Starmer could have made a better fist of trying to bring the party together. But I think he sees his role as to, you know, ring the changes. So that this morning I was on RT being interviewed about the other thing that he did this week, which is at Prime Minister's Questions, he called for the Prime Minister to ban RT, which isn't within the Prime Minister's power, in fact. But they've also written a letter, I understand, to Ofcom. This is from the Labour front bench, saying that they want a meeting with Ofcom to discuss why RT hasn't been banned. And, of course, it hasn't been banned because Ofcom, up to now, have been satisfied with the way they've fulfilled their obligations. But the Labour Party obviously want to make an issue of it. And both incidents really demonstrate that Starmer... he was a bit of an unknown quantity, and we can now sort of get a picture of where he wants to go.
Who you voted for? Are you regretting that yet?
Not really. I think we didn't have much of an option. Rebecca Long Bailey, if she had committed to proportional representation, she could have beaten Starmer, but she wasn't prepared to do that. And you see, John Landsman, who was one of the founders of Momentum, and of course he's got a Jewish background, he's come out and supported Starmer's apology. But I can tell you now, there's lots and lots of grassroots Labour activists who are very angry about this.
Well, this is mostly...
Because this is their money,
you know,
that's
what,
being thrown down.
This is mostly... It's very, very interesting that all these people have then come back immediately and said, here's some money for Corbyn. That's very significant. And also, many of the people who are going to be annoyed about this are the hundreds of thousands that joined the Labour Party under the Corbyn wave.
That's right. I mean, I was talking to James Boswell, who's up in Sheffield, and he was threatening to resign from the party, and I just said, well, that's part of the strategy. If lots of left-wing people get so angry with Starmer about
this... Well,
this
is what happened under Blair.
That's right, they'll all resign. But, I mean, that's never been my view. You shouldn't resign. If they've got it wrong, they've got it wrong. You should stay and fight with them. Just don't make it too easy for them, basically.
OK, so William, let's take those two incidents one by one. First of all, the Keir Starmer and his... Keir Starmer and his attempt to, actually Russia Today, we'll do that one second. But first, let's have a listen. I thought would be one of the best places to do this would be through listening to the Richie Allen show on Wednesday. He did quite a good job. He's one of the, bit like us, you know, sort of last man standing characters. And I go on his show from time to time and he does mine. But here he is saying what the mainstream media won't say about this stuff as he talks to... about the Panorama show and the comparison and the compensation, rather. And he has a little clip from Lisa Nandy too on there on Wednesday.
Speaking of the Labour Party, it has agreed to give substantial damages to 7 former employees who sued the party in this never-ending saga about anti-Semitism. You remember the Panorama programme last year. The party, Labour, has issued an unreserved apology in the High Court for making false and defamatory comments about these alleged whistleblowers. Now, back in July of last year, the Panorama programme, which was called Is Labour Anti-Semitic? That programme basically showed or displayed or featured a number of former party officials. And those former party officials alleged that senior figures close to Corbyn at the time interfered in the process of dealing with anti-Semitism complaints. They also claimed they faced a huge increase in complaints since Jeremy Corbyn became leader in 2015. At the time, Labour said these were disaffected former staff who had personal and political access to grind. And they were accused, were these whistleblowers, of trying to undermine Jeremy Corbyn. Now today, Corbyn said the decision to settle the claims with an apology and damages was disappointing. He said the party's legal advice was that it had a strong defence. He was echoed, was Corbyn, by union leader Len McCluskey. We can hear from the Shadow Foreign Secretary, Lisa Nandy, from Wigan, Lisa Nandy. Here's Lisa Nandy speaking to BBC Politics Today. She's overjoyed that we can put this anti-Semitism behind us.
Well, I just really welcome this. I was one of the very many people in the Labour Party who spoke out about the treatment of those whistleblowers. And I think this is a welcome step forwards that shows that Labour is now taking this seriously, and justice is being done. We've acknowledged that we got it wrong. That is the right thing to do, and we're taking steps today to set it right.
Not everyone on the left agrees with you. I think we can show our viewers this tweet from Len McCluskey, General Secretary of the Unite Union. He says today's settlement is a misuse of Labour Party funds. It could be in the region of £200,000. To settle a case, it was advised we could win in court. We would win in court. The leaked report on how anti-Semitism was handled tells a very different story about what happened. What do you say to that?
Yeah, powerful stuff from Len McCluskey.
That.
Well, I would just say that I believe that Len is completely wrong.
Well, you've got to say that, love. No career in politics for you if you disagree, if you agree with him. And you disagree with these whistleblowers who had no evidence, really, that there was any interference in any anti-Semitism investigation. But, of course, your career is ruined if you don't stand alongside the Zionist element of UK lobbyists in Westminster. You've got to say, oh, it's terrible, yeah, and I'm delighted that we've given these people money. Otherwise, you're finished, Lisa.
About that.
And that's how it works.
And that the way that a number of Labour Party staff, some very long-standing, some very young and new, who has...
Yeah. These allegations were baseless, without any foundation whatsoever, and they were solely... only to destroy and bring down Jeremy Corbyn, whom I, as you well know, have no time for whatsoever. No Labour supporter am I. Anyway, Lisa Nandy there.
So that's the Richie Allen Show, talking to Lisa Nandy about the interference, so-called interference, in the anti-Semitism investigation. Martin, this was looked at by Panorama. Was there any interference in the anti-Semitism investigation by Corbyn and his friends?
Well, I mean, the party's lawyers thought that they could win any such case. And what's happened here is an attempt to railroad people, basically. But, of course, it's failed because Corbyn, bless his cotton socks, has spoken up and said he's not happy with the decision. And John Ware, from Panorama, is going to sue him. But, of course, Corbyn has already got a fighting fund of 100 grand since Wednesday in order to go to court. And, of course, they should have gone to court. He'll have to go to court as an individual now. But, of course, this will all come out because the party's contention was that these people basically didn't fulfil their employment contracts. They were basically sabotaging what was going on and spreading fibs about the party's anti-Semitic views. And, of course, it's become a trope in mainstream politics that the party's anti-Semitic. What really is going on here? We know from the Al Jazeera sting that was done some years ago, where they basically filmed people from this Panorama programme who were working for the Labour Party, colluding with Mossad agents to sabotage Corbyn. And there it all was, on film.
That's Al Jazeera, the lobby. If you're looking for it online, you'd probably best not use Google. It might still pop up there.
But if it comes to court, that will be one of the things that could be used to undermine their position.
John Ware is an interesting figure, isn't he? Because he's the BBC producer that's made this documentary. He took over Panorama in the 1970s after doing what everyone was patting him on the back for at World in Action at Granada Television. This is going back a long, long way, and he goes back to there. And he did in 1973 an investigation into Nazi war criminals in South America, the sort of stuff we do. But the only thing is, he found Dr. Mengele, and he didn't find anybody else, because the year before, Stuart Stephen, the former Western Daily Press and also foreign editor of the Daily Express, had uncovered Martin Bormann living in South America. But so in a way, what Ware was doing with this World in Action film was saying, oh, let's just forget about Bormann, let's concentrate on Mengele. But he was annoying the Zionist lobby anyway, because he was going around under his normal name and his real name. And that may be why, you know, to this day, we think of Mengele as the Nazi war criminal hiding in South America, Martin, rather than Martin Bormann. That's all down to John Ware.
Yeah, as you say, he's an interesting character, definitely an insider. I think his most interesting work for Panorama was the exposure of Brigadier Gordon Kerr and the Force Research Unit in Northern Ireland and their close links with the UDA's Chief Intelligence Officer, Brian Nelson. who subsequently supposedly died but basically disappeared. In other words, what was exposed there was that the British Army were running the Loyalist paramilitary terror campaign. That's quite significant, and it was quite a good piece of journalism. But of course, nothing was ever done. Brigadier Gordon Kerr was not arrested, although he was looked into by Sir John Stevens of the Metropolitan Police. And of course, the Stalker also had a look at some of these things that they were up to. But of course, that's what happens. Even when you've got a good piece of journalism, it doesn't have any effect. People ignore it, and they just carry on as if nothing had happened. Although I do remember John Ware doorstepping Brigadier Gordon Kerr in Beijing, because he'd been sent to be a military attaché in Beijing, and John Ware turned up on the doorstep and started asking him about
the UDA. Well, that's it. So I suppose he'd been sort of hoofed out of the army into MI6.
He wasn't hoofed out of the army. He was just sent to Beijing so that nobody could interview
him.
Okay, so
his army...
Ware went over there to find him.
His army cover is quite nice for MI6, who can do all sorts of things illegal under British law.
Well, I don't know whether... the Force Research Unit was a very deep state unit, and it possibly wasn't directly related to MI6. The army's got its own deep state agents.
Well, I'm saying that's what he was doing in Beijing. He'd become a bit of a hot potato.
Well, no, they'd moved him to Beijing so that nobody could get hold of him, because who's going to... I mean, what, John Ware, presumably on BBC expenses, flew to Beijing and knocked on his door and said, excuse me, I want to ask you about the UDA. And, of course, what he did is he just slammed the door in his face and went back into the embassy.
So the other problem with, apparently, with... the Labour Party scandal, anyway, they're revealing this week, is the Russia collaboration story. And this is where the Tory party are actually collaborating, apparently, with Russians. And this is all related, I suppose, to the Intelligence and Security Committee report, which was supposed to come out last year, but it's taken a little while. And we can talk about that in a minute. But first of all, Prime Minister's questions, the Tory-Russia collaborators were discussed.
Ben Bradshaw. Mr. Speaker, I was the first member of this House to raise concerns about Russian interference in our democracy 4 years ago. By blocking the publication of the Russia report before the election on the grounds that the ISC committee has said we're spurious, and then trying to fix the committee, isn't it abundantly clear that this Prime Minister has knowingly and repeatedly put his own personal and party interests before the national security of our country?
No, Mr. Speaker, and I think that's a pretty lamentable way of looking at it, lamentable question, because, after all, if he thought there was genuinely something in the ISC report that showed that, for instance, the Brexit referendum had been undermined by Russia, then he would now be saying it, but that doesn't appear. And I'm afraid what you have here, as I'm afraid I've told the House several times, is the rage and fury of the Remainer elite, finding that there is in fact nothing in this report, and no smoking gun whatever, after all that froth and fury. And suddenly all those who want to remain in the EU find that they have no argument to stand on. And I regret that they should simply move on.
So with this Russia collaboration report, Martin, do you think it's that it was commissioned under one government, it's been published under another, and that there's been a certain amount of rubbing out been going on, some rubbers going and certain bits of it being deleted in the meantime?
Well, it was obviously heavily redacted. And in fact, as they were saying on RT this morning when I was on the show, on their shows, it's been redacted. And the bit that's been redacted is the bit about Russian interference in the elections. So, and if they're not going to tell us what that bit is, then it's not really much to, there's not really much
well,
to say
hope,
about
well, we're
it,
hoping
there?
For the evidence to be produced.
Well, no, but that's the bit, that's
start
the bit
taking
that,
it seriously well, rather than yes. all just hearsay.
Well, I think it's a big nothing burger, really. I mean, I was expecting there would be more sensational allegations in it, but there's hardly anything in it. What's in it, what's left of it when you look at it, is the fact that various wealthy Russians are donators to the Conservative Party. One of Putin's minor ministers' wives, who's a British citizen, paid 200 grand to pay tennis with Boris, presumably on the grounds that he has to let her win or something. But I mean, that, you know, wealthy people from all over the world, as long as they've got British passports, give money to the Tory party, including wealthy Russians, many of whom, of course, like one of them's a totally anti-Putin oligarch, and he's given money to the Tory party.
Well,
not surprising.
The suspicion here is that this money is just simply there to buy favours. The Russians are buying favours in the Tory party. Isn't that what's going on?
Yeah, but we're not talking about the Russian government. We're talking about wealthy Russians. And, of course, this is the whole thing about Putin's so-called gangster state. The wealthy elite in Russia, which robbed the society blind during the 1990s, they've all got their kids at Eton, and they've all got their penthouse flats in Kensington. And they fly backwards and forwards to Moscow all the time, and they invest a lot in British industry and finance, and they hobnob with top wealthy people, including top Tory politicians, and there's no real surprise there. But these people aren't, in fact, Putin. Some of them are, because business people, they just try and get on everybody's right side, but most of them are anti-Putin. And, of course, it's therefore, on what basis are we accusing the Russian government of interfering? The Russian government hasn't interfered. The people who don't like Putin have been giving money to the Tory party, and that's rather embarrassing.
Also, former ambassador, Craig Murray, has pointed out that he's had a look at this report, and there's actually nothing in it that's got anything to do with the secret intelligence services at all. It's actually all stuff that's been in the public domain.
That's right. And of course,
so why is the Intelligence and Security Committee even involved?
Well, it's because there was a lot of hoo-ha about the Russians are doing this, the Russians are doing that, so they commissioned a report. And of course, the main line taken in
the... And they came back with nothing.
Well, they came back with nothing, because the intelligence services, if you read Marina Hyde and others in The Guardian, the intelligence services are in the firing line because they didn't investigate stuff that wasn't happening. And of course, they should have investigated the stuff that wasn't happening, and therefore they're to blame and complacent, and therefore they should have more powers to investigate stuff, because they basically concentrated their time on focusing on things that were happening. I think, in any case, most rational adults will think, well, what realistic influence could Russia have over a British election? Even if they had a massive war chest, what would they spend it on, and what sort of result would they...
Well, they might advertise on Facebook, because there's all sorts of things. Well, but anyway, Martin, let's go to Prime Minister's questions now, because mm-hmm. Keir Starmer brought this up at PMQs, and here he is talking about this, you know, his view of this Russian election interference report, and of course the most important thing of it, from many people's point of view, is that it may be that the Russians changed the result, or the influence of the Russians changed the result of the Brexit referendum. But let's have a listen now to Starmer at PMQs.
This is a serious question. A serious question of national security. The Prime Minister sat on this report for 10 months and failed to plug a gap in our law on national security for a year and a half. Mr. Speaker, one of the starkest conclusions in the report is that the UK is clearly a target for Russian disinformation campaigns. The report also highlights that this is being met with a fragmented response across Whitehall and across the government. The report refers to this as a hot potato, with no one organisation recognising itself as having the overall lead. That's a serious gap in our defences. This is not about powers, it's about responsibility, Prime Minister. So how is the Prime Minister going to address that gap and make sure the UK meets this threat with the joined-up, robust response it deserves?
Mr. Speaker, there is no other government in the world that takes some more robust steps to protect our democracy, to protect our critical national infrastructure, and to protect our intellectual property, as I have said, from interference by Russia or by anyone else. And frankly, I think that everybody understands that these criticisms are motivated by a desire to undermine the referendum on the European Union, the membership of the European Union, that took place in 2016, the result of which he simply cannot bring himself to accept.
Well, that's as maybe, but Martin, he's pointing out there, Starmer, that we have this enormous gap in our security, this enormous gap in our defences, although the Intelligence and Security Committee haven't presented any evidence that gap is being exploited by the Russians.
Well, I mean, as I said this morning, this whole idea that the Russians are influencing Western democracies really took off with the idea that they'd hacked the Democratic National Committee's computers and then passed on to WikiLeaks everything that was found there, which showed that the in the run-up to the 2016 election, that Bernie Sanders was being basically sabotaged by the DNC National Committee. They were rigging the primary election.
But they seem to have done that this time with Biden. Well, they got rid of Sanders.
Well, the problem is that was his best chance, Sanders, the last time. And, of course, this time it was difficult for him to get the same momentum. But what they did, I mean, the way they dealt with this is instead of looking at the actual emails and what they showed, they immediately started this hue and cry, there's a squirrel, the Russians must have hacked this out, it's so damaging and it gives such a bad impression of US democracy, this must be a foreign power making us look bad. Now, of course, just logically, that's just wrong. Even if the Russians had hacked it out, and of course they didn't, Craig Murray actually got an MP3 from the insider that gave it to him, possibly Seth Rich, who then died in a very mysterious non-robbery. The fundamental problem with it is that they're not actually addressing the real problem, which is that US democracy is rigged. And it's not the Russians who are rigging it, and it's not the Russian intelligence services who are rigging it. It's the Western intelligence services. And when they get caught, they immediately scream, it's the Russians, it's
the Russians.
Well,
it's interesting you mentioning hacking there, because this is, obviously, this is the way that they're going, but there is hacking going on. And it does worry me that, and we picked up on this, it was, I was having a listen in the car to the Alex Thompson interview, which is last week we did with the former GCHQ officer, Alex Thompson. You can go back and find that if you want on thisweek.org.uk for what was it? I think the 20th of July show. 17th of July show. But what he pointed out on that program, so just a quick clip back from last week's, which I hadn't picked up on at the time, is that the way that, okay, so we've got these Five Eyes intelligence services, including GCHQ, the NSA, etc., the signals intelligence people, keeping an eye on things. But the involvement of the Israelis is particularly pernicious because their version, Unit 8200, is not officially declared, so we're talking about Six Eyes rather than Five. And not only that, but the Israeli unit is also involved, and they're quite proud of their ability to alter information whilst it's on people's computers, delete files and this sort of thing. And I've mentioned this because I've noticed some of my files being deleted recently. You know, you go back and think, well, where's that email? It's just completely disappeared. I mean, I've got a proprietary email. It doesn't sit on the internet. It sits on my computer, but the email's been deleted somehow. And so let's have a listen, a review, Martin, to this whole idea of hacking by the intelligence services and the Israeli intelligence unit 8200, potentially anyway, using the Six Eyes, undeclared Six Eyes, to get away with doing things like that all in other parts of the world. So let's have a listen to that clip from last week's interview with Alex now.
And there's also a very under-discussed Israeli angle to all this, which we see popping up in areas such as recently when the National Health Service for Britain, and particularly its data and technical arm, NHSX, started partnering with GCHQ. And who's in the background of that? Matthew Gould, former British ambassador in Tel Aviv. And then we get some very strange links going through to Unit 8200, the Israeli Signals Intelligence Agency, which actually is also active. It does things that would be unlawful and illegal in Britain and America, which is actually fiddled with data while it's not in transit, which would be breaking the terms of the statutory bounds of only looking at communications. So more hacking and shaping views among the public. Something the Third Reich also did with its intelligence agency, particularly the Signals Intelligence Bureau, did that.
Naughty, naughty Alex Thompson there, who has a regular slot, I think it's once a week, on the UK column, in which comes out of Plymouth, most pretty much daily at lunchtimes. They have a programme. But Martin, what the point he's making there is pretty devastating, isn't he? He's saying that actually this hacking is going on, potentially by intelligence services, with the collaboration of the top people in the British, American, Canadian, New Zealand, Australian intelligence services too. And the idea that it might be, in fact, it is illegal for it to happen in Britain. Legalities don't allow it. It's easy enough for them to farm it out so that someone else can be using this. But the point here being that, you know, this could be happening to MPs' computers, lawyers' computers, journalists' computers too.
Yeah, I think anybody who thinks that you're using any electronic equipment that you're not hackable has missed the point. And, of course, the
state hacking is something else, isn't
it? Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, and they can say that it's illegal and we don't do it, but do you believe them? And in any case, the way they got around the legalities, as you say, is that the British spy on the Americans and then give it to the Americans, and the Americans spy on the British and then give it to the British. So it's not, in fact, the British you are spying on us directly. It'll be the US and the Israelis.
Aren't these institutions supposed to be spying on our enemies, not on us?
Well, the whole point of it, I mean, unless you're not going to have intelligence services at all, and there's a case for that. I mean, maybe the police should do everything. Why do you need intelligence services? There is a case for intelligence services doing specialised stuff.
Well, the police are more accountable for stuff.
Well, that's why they have. But in any case, intelligence services used to be there simply to collect information to pass to the political leadership. But once the CIA was set up in the 1940s, the British had done this for years and they just blooded them in, you're there to actually steer events.
Yeah, covert
operations. You're not just collecting information, you're actually trying to steer things in the direction you want to go.
Let's try and steer things back to the Keir Starmer at Prime Minister's Questions, where he's talking about Russians having a licence for disinformation using a certain programme, which you were on earlier today, Martin, called Russia Today.
A serious gap in our Official Secrets Act, laying bare for 18 months, and that's all the Prime Minister has to say about it. One way the government can seek to clamp down on Russian influence is to prevent the spread of Kremlin-backed disinformation. Obviously, social media companies have a big role to play, but the report also highlights serious distortions in the coverage provided by Russian state-owned international broadcasters such as Russia Today. The High Court has ruled that Russia Today broadcasts pose actual and potential harm. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that it's time to look again at the licensing for Russia Today to operate in the UK?
Mr. Speaker, I think this would come more credibly from the Leader of the Opposition had he called out the former Leader of the Opposition when he took money for appearing on Russia Today. I mean, Mr. Speaker, he protested neither against the former Leader of the Opposition's stance on Salisbury nor against his willingness to take money from Russia Today. He flip-flops from day to day, Mr. Speaker. One day he's in favour of staying in the EU, the next day he's willing to accept Brexit. Mr. Speaker, the Leader of the Opposition has more flip-flops than Bournemouth Beach. Oh.
Flip-flops, Alexander Stafford.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last week, the party opposite bravely abstained on a vote that attempted to tie us into the EU indefinitely, further highlighting the increasing detachment of Labour from the old heartlands like Rother Valley. Can my right honourable friend, the Prime Minister, confirm that we on this side of the House remain fully committed to living our promises to the British people and are restoring our full economic independence on the 1st of January so the people of Thurcroft, Nortby, Diddington and across Rother Valley get the Brexit bonanza and level up that we so deserve?
Yeah, so the main part of that was the first part of the question. We didn't really need the second one. But, Martin, this is Keir Starmer really going to the right of Boris here, saying, look, we should cut off the broadcast licence for Russia Today. He doesn't want to hear what you've got to say this morning, for example.
Well, as I pointed out this morning, another journalist on Russia Today pointed out this morning, it's not up to the Prime Minister to decide who's allowed to broadcast.
No, but he can send a strong letter to Ofcom, can't he?
Yes, but Ofcom are supposed to be above political pressure. If they're in a situation where
but
the
you
government
can bet there's political appointments there.
Well, indeed, but the point is, officially, it may well be that arms can be twisted and testicles can be crushed behind the scenes, but officially, Ofcom decides, not the Prime Minister. Even if Keir Starmer was the Prime Minister, he's not in a position to close down journalistic
outlets.
Why is he
trying to shut the mouth of the English language Russia broadcasters like you?
Because basically, there's a huge deep state project to continue conflict between Russia and the West. It's called Operation Beluga. We know it's called Operation Beluga because Paul Borel, who's a former head of the French anti-terrorist squad and used to be in Berezovsky's, in London, Berezovsky's protection squad, he said whenever there is a possibility of a serious discussion between Russians and the West, then the intelligence services come up with various stunts to prevent it from
happening. Russians, to be fair to them, on Wednesday, just came up with one word reply, didn't they? This is Russophobia.
Yeah, I mean, basically...
They didn't bother to really try and explain.
Well, I mean, because there's nothing to it. I mean, Russia today has had various run-ins with Ofcom, and Ofcom have, you know, ticked them off in various ways, and they've tried to work within the rules. And they, as far as they're concerned, the rules are there, and they're prepared to abide within those rules. But you can't have a situation where politicians, that's what we're talking about, can tell the independent regulator of journalistic endeavour on TV and etc. Because it doesn't cover written journalism. Anybody can write any old rubbish in a newspaper, and you can't be sued. You can't unless you've libelled somebody. The government certainly doesn't demand that the Daily Mail give Jeremy Corbyn a fair go and a right of reply.
Why is the leader of the Labour opposition trying to muzzle media that he doesn't agree with?
Because they're basically trying to...
I mean, there's the Daily Mail as well, isn't there? Why doesn't he try and shut the Daily Mail up?
Well, because he can't. It's only because RT is a TV station that they have to fulfil various criteria. And I think that's fair enough. I mean, if you want to be a TV station, I think you should have to fulfil various criteria. But it doesn't mean that you've got to say what everybody else wants you to say. The whole point of having pluralism in the media is nobody forces you to watch RT. If you don't like it, you can switch over and watch Fox News or BBC.
Five years.
France 24 or anything you like, can't
5 years or so ago, the Iranian English language broadcaster Press TV, which I do stuff for still from time to time, they were completely banned as well. So we've got a bizarre situation here where we are acting a little bit like the Nazis were in the Second World War, because they were the ones that started banning foreign broadcasts all the way through World War II. The British allowed Lord Horhall to broadcast from Radio Luxembourg in English with German propaganda right the way through the war. There was a discussion and a debate about whether they should try and jam it. And they said, no, well, what we'll do is we'll just point out the misinformation that the Germans are giving, and we'll also ridicule it. So they didn't want to do any banning, but we now do.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is that RT has got quite a dynamic audience of younger people. It's got a livelier presentational style. The Kaiser Report is far more informative about what's happening in financial markets than the dreary dollops of BBC, etc. And it's actually quite effective in communicating the Russian point of view. And I think surely, in the modern world, we need to hear the Russian point of view.
Well, we need
to hear the Chinese point of view.
For example, Martin, we had Ian Fraser on this programme a few years ago, the freelance columnist, I think it was for the Glasgow Herald, he writes quite a lot. He was saying the big problem with financial journalism in London is that all of the financial journalists in London, that is to say all of the staffers for the main London media, are all far, far too close to the institutions they're supposed to be reporting on. So they're just not critical anymore. They just tell the viewers and listeners what the industry wants them to hear.
That's right.
So they're like doing PR, basically.
That's right. And of course, RT has actually made finance exciting and interesting to a younger audience, because they've got a different presentational style, and it's also very informative. Now, of course, they don't like that. They don't like it up them. Then, you know, the BBC doesn't like having competition. And of course, they've been shown up, for example, over the BBC Russia sent their Russian correspondents into Ukraine after the MH17 shootdown to talk to locals on the ground, who all informed them that the plane had been shot down by aircraft from Kiev, by fighter aircraft. That was put up on BBC Russia's Moscow website. Of course, most people in England don't read Russian, so they didn't even realise. And then as soon as BBC London realised that BBC Russia had put this up, they took it down. But of course, it's there, out there in the world of internet. And of course, it completely disproved the theory that it had been shot down by a Russian missile.
I mean, I found myself this week wondering, why is it that Russia seems to be so important? Why this Russophobia? Why have we got to make up all these stories about how terrible Russia is? At least, you know, it wouldn't be so bad if there was actually any evidence to back it up. It just seems almost fevered to me. But then I start thinking, well, actually, it's because in a potential coming conflict between the United States and China, whether that be economic or a shooting war, actually, the Chinese, Martin, the Russians could be the crucial third player.
Well, I think the real, that they turned against the Russians. Putin was originally regarded as one of their men. And when he first came to power, I was very suspicious of Putin because I thought he's just an enforcer for the IMF gangsters. But of course,
well, that's what Berezovsky thought when he put him there.
That's what Berezovsky thought when he put him there. That's right. And of course, Berezovsky ultimately committed suicide, supposedly in Surrey, although the local coroner wouldn't accept that he committed suicide.
And it'd be interesting to see what Paul Burrell had to say about that, having worked with him.
And that's right. And of course, in actual fact, you'd have thought Berezovsky being an enemy of Putin and he commits suicide, but the coroner won't accept that it's suicide. They should have been screaming on the front Daily Mail headlines, you know, Berezovsky murdered by Putin. But of course, they didn't do that because he wasn't murdered by Putin, but he was murdered. And, of course, his daughter believes that he was murdered by the British. And I don't suppose anybody in West Belfast is surprised that the British murder people. But, of course, in Middle England, we don't do stuff like that. So, ipso facto, it must be the Russians. But, of course, that's just wrong. The British spycraft is very sophisticated, and they do wet work as well as other work.
And also, I mean, with the whole Skripal business, I mean, looking at that, you do wonder what the point of that was. It looked to me as if Sergei Skripal was trying to leave Britain, and because this is what we'll be talking a bit about this in the second hour, is he was trying to leave Britain. There's a letter published in the Independent newspaper, or an article, a few weeks after the Skripal incident, saying, well, actually, he wanted to return to Russia. Now, that could have been a potential disaster, Martin, couldn't it? Because if he suddenly pops up on Russian TV saying, oh, yeah, I work with this guy called Christopher Steele, and we put together a dossier about Trump and all sorts of sordid stuff, including interfering in US elections, that could be a bit embarrassing.
Yeah, it was probably more to do with the fact that he knew what had happened to Litvinenko. And Litvinenko wasn't murdered by the Russians either. I know it's surprising for people if you're in the mainstream, because we all know that the Russians did that. Although the polonium, I mean, why would you murder somebody with polonium, which is radioactive and can be traced? Nobody would do that in their right mind.
Yeah, Yasser Arafat, by the way, his toothbrush, they found polonium on that.
Well, maybe. But I mean, the polonium, when the Metropolitan Police traced the polonium trail, it led back to Berezovsky's office. Because Berezovsky and criminals like him who used to run Russia in the 1990s, they were involved in all sorts of things like that. Selling nuclear materials, fixing elections, of carrying out false flag terrorist attacks. So Berezovsky is a very key person. And if he defected back to Russia, he would have a great deal of information about the disinformation campaigns
run by the
West.
About this
and
is
that couldn't be allowed, so he was snuffed.
That we've been, Skripal is what we're talking about now. Now, we've been left with the impression that actually he's sitting pretty here in Britain, he's having a nice time, and actually the real threats to him are the Russians. Actually, it could be the other way around.
It could be. I mean, it's very bizarre, isn't it? And both his daughter and the police officer could be imprisoned
by MI6.
Yes,
basically.
Well, I mean, his daughter, don't forget, was engaged to be married in Russia and has not gone back to her fiancé. She's just disappeared. Extraordinary, you'd have thought.
So these people have apparently been disappeared. They've been disappeared for their own protection, apparently.
Yes, well, that may or may not be the case. I think what really is going on here is an ongoing attempt to blacken Russia, and therefore the whole Skripal affair in Salisbury is essentially theatre by the British intelligence services.
Okay, well, look, I thought we'd have a listen to Tuesday when this announcement was made, PM programme, with, I call him Gollum, Evan Davis on the BBC giving the commentary, as he looks a bit like him on Newsnight. So let's have a listen now to the first clip from that, where they talk about this being kind of nihilistic paranoia that the Russians have about Britain.
Well, it's a big foreign policy day, big foreign policy week, really. Look at China in the news, Mike Pompeo here, and that Russia report. It's a take-stock moment for the country, and we're going to be taking stock towards the end of the programme. But on that Russia report, it has been long-awaited, an important take on maliciously intended disruption of public life here. So let's take a few minutes to examine it. Came from Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee, and here is a key line on what we're up against.
The security threat posed by Russia is difficult for the West to manage as, in our view and that of many others, it appears fundamentally nihilistic. Russia seems to see foreign policy as a zero-sum game. any actions it can take which damage the West are fundamentally good for Russia. It is also seemingly fed by paranoia, believing that Western institutions such as NATO and the EU have a far more aggressive posture towards it than they do in reality.
Well, Russia, it is argued, thinks of the UK as a top target.
Russia's cyber capability, when combined with its willingness to deploy it in a malicious capacity, is a matter of grave concern and poses an immediate and urgent threat to our national security.
Urgent threat to national security, including in the report, to critical infrastructure, it argues.
So, yes, urgent threat to national security, Martin, but no evidence for it. I find it fascinating that they use this word, that the Russians are nihilistic and that they're paranoid, because they're starting to move into almost philosophical and psychological areas, aren't evidenced by anything, really.
No, and of course, if you think about it, the idea of Russia as this other, this enemy of the British Empire, goes back to the 19th century. We don't want to fight, but by jingo, if we do, we've got the men, we've got the ships, we've got the bullets too, and the Russians shall not have Constantinople. That is a trope going back to the 19th century.
So what's the fundamental basis of this Russophobia then, if that's what this is?
Well, I mean, when we really started to get annoyed with the Russians, the West massively intervened in the 1990s in Russia. At one stage, Boris Yeltsin was narrowly, very, very narrowly re-elected, because all these bombs went off in Ryazan and Moscow.
99, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, 98. It was 98 election. But 99 was when the bombs went off. But in any case, there was massive intervention to prop up Yeltsin, so that Western multinationals and their friends, you know, Magnitsky, who we're going to hear about later, Khodorkovsky, Berezovsky, and all of these Russian oligarchs, many of whom have dual Russian-Israeli citizenship, which is just a fact, were ripping off the country. And the Russians remember this very well. Living standards collapsed. The death rate massively shot up. The average age of death went down. So, you know,
the other thing about the oligarchs, a terrible time for them. I mean, we will be talking quite a lot more about the oligarchs in the second hour, but the other thing about them was that they had these basically open checkbooks from Swiss bank accounts.
That's right. I mean, we were perfectly happy with the Russian government when it was run by puppets of the West, who would allow Western multinationals to do pretty much what they wanted and give them access to all of the goodies in Siberia. And Putin came to power through a fairly abstract process. And he basically put his foot down and said, we're not doing that. We're not giving our national assets to you for nothing.
What do Intelligence and Security Committee mean when they say the Russians are nihilistic?
Well, the idea they've got is that anything that the Russians...
What does it mean?
Well, nihilism, in fact, is interesting. If you wonder the history of nihilism, in the 19th century, the great inventor of nihilism was Sergei... what was his name? It wasn't Pugachev. It was... I'll have to look it up.
Sergei, anyway, yeah.
Yep. And nihilism was, you know, it was part of the philosophical ferment in Russia in the run-up to the Russian Revolution. And the nihilists were very, like, extreme anarchists, really. And then, of course, it went into the general language as meaning people who were just negative about everything, just wanted to destroy, you know, and all of the rest of it. But of course, what's really...
Well, it's having no values, no morals.
Yeah, but which is...
Basically, isn't the idea that you just do whatever it takes and you don't think about...
Yeah, that's right.
The
idea that Russians are basically nihilistic is fundamentally racist. Russia is a society like any others with interests, and it's got national interests, just as Britain has national interests.
Oh, so
it's not nihilistic. They've got very concrete goals.
I've just looked him up. He's Sergei Nechayev.
Nechayev, that's right. I've forgotten the name. And of course, he was a friend of Bakunin's, or he used to work in his circle, who's the founder of Russian anarchism, unless you include Kropotkin. But the point about this is, they are projecting onto the Russians their own worldview. They are nihilistic about Russia. They don't see a Russia with its own goals and values as acceptable.
Martin, this is worrying. This is what psychopaths do. They project onto others their own psychological problems or their own misdemeanours.
Indeed. Well, it's not even misdemeanours. If you think about, we were talking earlier about the shoot down of MH17. That was carried out probably by Ukrainian aircraft, and it was a deliberate, they knew what they were doing. And they did it probably under the orders of Paribi, who was in charge of security at that stage, in order to force the West to bring sanctions in against Russia. The people that were shot down in the Maidan Square at the beginning of the crisis
in Ukraine,
there's been a court case in Ukraine where the Berkut riot police were exonerated because the people who'd actually done the sniping and killed the 80-odd people testified, two of them testified from Georgia and said, we did that. We were flown in to Poland to the Warsaw Police Academy, and we then went to Kiev and we shot those people, and these people are innocent, and they had to let them go. That's a court case in Kiev, totally unreported.
Okay, well, let's get back to the Russian interference in the British elections report, which came out on Tuesday, and back to Evan Davis and PM, this time looking at this apparent idea of something called Londonograd, which is the financial influence.
Now, it also argues that too many Brits have responded to Putin's Russia by looking for commercial opportunity. Here's how Labour MP Kevin Jones, he's one of those on the committee, how he put it.
Successive governments have welcomed Russian oligarchs and their money with open arms. And there is a lot of Russians with very close links to Putin who are now very well integrated into both UK business, political and social scene, in what has been referred to as Londongrad.
Londongrad. Well, as the report said, there are many hangers-on here.
The arrival of Russian money resulted in a growth industry of enablers, individuals and organisations who manage and lobby for the Russian elite in the UK. Lawyers, accountants, estate agents and PR professionals have played a role, wittingly or unwittingly, in the extension of Russian influence, which is often linked to promoting the nefarious interests of the Russian state.
They also pointed the finger at some members of the House of Lords, incidentally, and called Russian influence the new normal.
Still waiting, Martin, for anything substantial in this report. Nothing much there. That was a Labour MP, Kevin Jones, there, commenting, who's on the Intelligence and Security Committee. Lots and lots of innuendo, but nothing really substantial.
Well, what you've got to recognise is that you only get on the Security and Intelligence Committee if you're regarded as a safe pair of hands from the point of view of the British deep state. So you've got a lot of, basically, arse-lickers there.
OK, so let's get into a bit further into this report, into the former... there's two senior people who were involved, first of all, in the commissioning and secondly in the implementation of this report. First, the Tory old Intelligence and Security Committee chair, who was booted out by his constituents in the December general election. That's Dominic Grieve.
The report was written last year, and that was written by a committee of parliamentarians that has largely now changed because we had an election between it being written and now. But we can hear from the former chair of it, former MP Dominic Grieve, who was obviously there when it was being written. And a very good afternoon to you, Mr. Grieve.
Good afternoon. My interpretation is that the government's eye was off the ball. There was no desire. Firstly, it's perfectly clear that the close monitoring of the referendum in 2016, which one might have expected in view of the risks that were beginning to emerge from Russia's past record of interfering in democratic processes, doesn't appear to have taken place. Secondly, there appears to have been absolutely zero desire subsequently when it became plain that Russia was interfering in many democratic processes, not just in the United Kingdom, but elsewhere, to go back and revisit whether that had actually happened during the 2016 referendum.
We didn't say, now, hey, I wonder if they did that here, given that they did it in the US.
As to what the motive was, I think I would be rather careful. I'd be guarded, because there can be all sorts of motives.
Right.
But the simple fact is that it didn't happen. And our concern was that as part of it, I want to emphasize, this report was not just about Russia and elections. I know it's
it's got all sorts of other stuff.
It's a much wider report. But as part of it, we did want to look about Russia and elections and Russia and subversion of democratic processes in democratic countries. And we were a bit startled when, having made the request for could you supply us with the information that you have on this particular subject, what actually arrived was extraordinarily limited, in fact, almost non-existent.
Right, a few lines and what had been on RT and Russian television.
And it was plain to us that this was a subject which was regarded as very delicate.
Right, but look,
now, there I have some sympathy with the agencies because, you know, on the whole, in a democracy, you don't want agencies looking into your own internal, normally your democratic processes. But if they're threatened by external actors, we've got to look into it, and it should be a government priority, and it should be something which can be actually approached, and I'm sure can be approached, on a completely bipartisan basis.
Well, it's amazing, really, that Evan Davis didn't ask him anything about why there was no actual substance in this report, because even he, Dominic Grieve there, is admitting that there was nothing really in it.
Yes, and of course, what you're getting from Grieve and also from Marina Hyde in The Guardian and others is that MI5 and MI6 are to blame because they should have found something, but it may well be that MI5 didn't look for it because there's nothing there. And they probably know that all this stuff about interference in elections, it all comes back to the supposed hack of the Democratic National Committee and the emails which showed that this was basically being rigged.
Well, look,
the evidence for that is zero.
Okay.
It's actually the opposite.
We're going to go from the one Dominic to another Dominic now. That's Dominic Grieve, who's out on his ear in the last general election, from being Attorney General, etc., to the new Dominic Raab, who's now Foreign Secretary. What does he make of this Russia report?
So, fingers pointed at Russia, fingers pointed at inadequate UK response. Let's get some responses. Russia always enjoys puncturing any British self-importance, and the line from the ambassador, Andrei Kellin, was to say that it excessively overestimates the role of Britain in Russian foreign policy. It does not have such a role in it, he told TASS. As for the government here, this afternoon, the Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, was asked whether the government had actively avoided looking for evidence of Russian interference into the Brexit referendum.
You mentioned the suggestion that the UK had actively avoided investigating Russia. I think, in fairness, you'll find that wasn't in the ISC report. It was the comment of one MP, Stuart Hosey, and we categorically reject that. I think if you look, we've got a long period recognising the enduring and significant threat posed by Russia to the UK, including in relation to cyber. Russia is a top national security priority.
Okay, so Martin, we're looking at this really bizarre situation here. I can't imagine it from all of our previous broadcasts and analysis of what's going on, that you've got the Labour Party being far more Russophobic and critical of Russia than the Conservatives. You would have thought that it would be the other way around, surely.
Well, not really. I mean, during the Yeltsin era, plenty of Russian oligarchs, as I say, established themselves over here.
Is it because they're jealous? Because the oligarchs tend to give money to the Tories,
them? as you can imagine, wealthy people tend to give money to the Tories, and therefore the Labour Party think that they can make some kind of hay out of this. But what's underlying all of this is just a refusal to understand the deviousness of their own deep state, the deep state that carried on a dirty war in Northern Ireland for 30 years. The deep state that is currently many of our military are over in Saudi Arabia helping the Saudi military to butcher the Yemenis and the biggest humanitarian catastrophe on the planet. But we're not hearing anything about that. And don't forget the Saudis, they have their chaps all trained at Sandhurst. They're all at Cranwell being shown how to fly aeroplanes as we speak. Their kids all go to our schools. And we've got basically the wealthy elite of the world comes to this country to get to know the other wealthy elite people, and the Russians are no exception. But many of them, like Berezovsky and others, are very hostile to Putin. But they're Russian. And, of course, the Russians are just nihilistic. They just hate our freedoms.
OK, well, I think we'll leave Russia there for now and concentrate for a while on the COVID-19 so-called pandemic, I did post plenty of stuff last week at thisweek.org.uk, and maybe I ought to do it all the time permanently, really, on the actual numbers. In fact, in Bristol, there was actually a news story this week where one person in Bristol had died, and they considered that to be news. And yet we're looking at the potential of having lockdowns here in Bristol, specific individual lockdowns, just because of people testing positive, Martin, even if they don't have any symptoms. So this is, we're getting into a very bizarre stage where there's people who are not ill, but they're causing citywide lockdowns potentially.
Well, I mean, if you look at successful countries that have dealt with this, like New Zealand, where they had 27 deaths, or Vietnam, where they had zero deaths, or China, where they've had less than 4,000 deaths, I think you'll find that the way the British establishment has handled this has been execrable. And, of course, we're now still not sorted. And the reason why anybody who shows positive, they can spread it to other people. And I'm afraid we're not out of the woods yet by a long way.
Well, they can spread it to other people, but as we were hearing last week, for example, even kids that test positive are not spreading it because it doesn't it's not showing symptoms. They're not coughing, spluttering, etc. So you know, this is another aspect to this whole pandemic, so-called pandemic, which is extremely questionable. But anyway, I thought we'd have a listen now because we had a bit of entertaining stuff from Dr. Vernon Coleman last week. We have a listen to him now. Another section on elderly people, because he is very concerned about the way elderly people have been treated, and he thinks that particularly in care homes there's been lots and lots of totally unnecessary elderly people have been killed. And he also links it here to the pension companies, who rather don't like having to keep paying out pensions to lots of elderly living people.
The real tragedy here is, although this was the worst mass slaughter of the elderly in modern history, it isn't actually anything new. Old people have been murdered for years without anyone taking any notice. Euthanasia, sometimes admitted and sometimes not, is now commonly practiced in so-called civilized societies around the world, and the elderly are invariably the victims. For many years in the UK, doctors and nurses were encouraged to follow something called the Liverpool Care Pathway. This was a murderous charter which allowed doctors and nurses to withhold food, water and essential treatment from patients who were over 65 and who were, therefore, regarded as an expensive and entirely disposable nuisance. Then the Liverpool Care Pathway was replaced by something called Sustainable Development Goals, which originated with the United Nations and which is, therefore, global. Sustainable Development Goals allows doctors and hospitals to discriminate against anyone over the age of 70 on the grounds that people who die when they're over 70 cannot be said to have died prematurely and so will not count when the nation's healthcare is being assessed. Governments everywhere love this new rule because it gives the state permission to get rid of citizens who are of pensionable age and therefore regarded by society's accountants as a burden. In Holland, one eminent doctor has claimed that the elderly are not admitted to hospitals and certainly not to intensive care units. The Netherlands does not hospitalise the weak, he said, and the elderly in order to make room for young people. Don't believe me? A survey of 6,600 patients in the Netherlands found that treatment, including drugs, food and water, were most likely to be withheld from the over 65s. And in 56% of cases, doctors didn't bother to discuss their failure to treat with their patients or the patients' relatives. I've also seen claims that the elderly are routine killed in Germany, France, Italy and Spain. Age has become a criterion for triage. Genocide is coming to a town near you, if it isn't already there. Back in 2015, when doctors in America were reported to be withholding treatment from elderly patients, doctors said it wasn't ageism. They didn't say what it was, though. It certainly wasn't stamp collecting, and it wasn't kindness or proper, decent medical practice. Michael Bloomberg, the billionaire who nearly became the Democratic presidential candidate in 2020, said America should deny health care to the elderly. There was no suggestion that the morality of it be discussed. In Canada, patients have been buried without postmortems, and as elsewhere, they were said to have died of the coronavirus if they were thought to have had the bug. Presumably, if a patient with a knife sticking out of their chest had sneezed within 14 days of their death, then they died of coronavirus. This isn't entirely new, of course. In the UK, it was back in February 2005 that it was revealed that the British government had advised that hospital patients with little hope of recovery should be allowed to die because of the cost of keeping them alive. The key words were little hope of recovery. Those words that don't mean anything. Any doctor worthy of the name will tell you that they've seen patients get better despite there being little hope of recovery. But Tony Blair's Labour government suggested that old people be denied the right to food and water if they fell into a coma or couldn't speak for themselves. We shouldn't be surprised, I suppose. The utterly loathsome Blair is, after all, now one of the world's richest war criminals. I don't believe in capital punishment, but we should bring back the death penalty just for him. So, patients should be killed if they couldn't speak for themselves. So much for any hope for stroke victims. Blair's government suggested that the need to cut costs came before the need to preserve the right lives of patients and decided it had the right to overturn a right-to-life ruling which had been made when a judge ordered that artificial nutrition and hydration should not be withdrawn unless the life of a patient could be described as intolerable. The judge had added that when there was any doubt, preservation of life should take precedence. But depriving the elderly of food and water is done all the time. Drinks or food are put on a tray, and if the patient is too ill or weak to reach them, then they're taken away untouched. In most hospitals, no one bothers to feed patients who can't feed themselves. Meanwhile, the government pours money into vanity projects and wastes money on foreign aid programs, which result in crooked politicians putting billions into Swiss bank accounts. And they merrily subsidise the lives of the lazy and the work shy to buy their votes. Healthy 30-year-olds sit around growing chip backsides and beer bellies, slumped in front of their high-definition digital television sets and opening the windows to let the heat out, because it's easier than turning down the central heating. But the elderly are classified as the unwanted generation. Anyone of pensionable age is a political embarrassment to be ignored or dumped or killed. Elderly individuals facing blindness from age-related macular disease are denied drugs that might have prevented their blindness because they're considered useless and expendable. The theory is that they don't contribute and rarely vote and can therefore be disregarded. How have we managed to forget that in the 1930s the Nazis deliberately starved and dehydrated elderly and vulnerable patients because they were regarded as a useless burden on society?
So there's Dr. Vernon Coleman, who's got a very particularly black sense of humour, Martin. I'm not sure if it's your sense of humour, but he is really sort of doing a kind of, I suppose, sit-down, stand-up comedy in his armchair every day now to do with the pandemic. And one of the things he talks about quite a lot there, but I mean, it's difficult to believe, isn't it, that any healthcare system could actually be designed to kill people. It's supposed to be there to keep you alive. But we've seen, haven't we, with the pharmaceutical industry, never mind the hospitals and that sort of thing, that it can actually make more money if you get people dependent on a drug than if you actually cure them.
Well, that's certainly true. And, of course, some of the things he's saying about trying to save money by getting rid of elderly people, I think there's a lot in that. Although when he says they don't vote, they vote far more than younger people. So, in actual fact, in many ways, a lot of policies are pursued are in the interests of elderly homeowners rather than, for example, gig workers who are never going to get on the property ladder.
He was having a go at he was saying, we should slash foreign aid because it's a waste of money. Mm. And he got his wish, didn't he, this week, because foreign aid bills slashed by £3 billion for this year. And number 10 is going to be pulling funding from China. I just think this is fascinating, the way this has worked over the years. This this money is used for things like the British Council, which are called kind of, I think, isn't it, white propaganda or soft propaganda. Mm. The idea is it's paying for British influence abroad. And whilst the government is taking away £3 billion from this, there are all sorts of other civil society organisations, least of which is the Open Society Project of George Soros, who are actually taking over in a way where this money is left off. So they're buying influence in civil society in these countries where the foreign aid budget is being slashed. It's almost as if there's a kind of private network taking over where these foreign policy decisions and foreign policy spending is being withdrawn.
Yeah, I mean, there's a book called Foreign Aid Reconsidered, and I think it's by Curry. I read it in the 1990s when I was working for CAFORD. And of course, the case for foreign aid is quite complex. And of course, in the Cold War, during the Korean War, for example, and subsequently, British foreign aid served two major purposes. One, as you say, to bolster British soft power. Also, to give markets to British companies. Yeah, you can have some foreign aid as long as you buy our stuff. So the Tanzanians, for example, were inveigled into buying
Foreign Aid Reconsidered is by Roger Riddell.
Oh, Riddell. Okay, I've forgotten the name. Yeah, but anyway, that's an academic study of foreign aid and why countries make foreign aid and so on. If anybody's interested.
Well, why do they?
Well, I'm just coming to that. Okay. During the Cold War, British foreign aid, like US foreign aid, was basically because the Chinese and the Russians were going around all over the developing world saying, we will give you some money in order to defeat the imperialists. And of course, the West and the Americans could have said, well, we're not going to give you any money, we're just going to rip you off. But of course, if they'd done that, they'd have lost the Cold War. But they didn't lose the Cold War. And now, of course, what's going on now is the National Endowment for Democracy is going around all over the world funding political parties which are in favour of US policy and interfering in other people's elections. And that's what foreign aid is all about. In Mozambique, when Frelimo came to power, they banned all outside foreign aid, apart from NGOs that they knew and trusted. And basically, in the developing world, Western aid is regarded as a Trojan horse for Western companies and influence, and the more radical places won't touch it with a barge pole.
So, today is Mask Day. That is to say, midnight last night, every shop that you go into, and probably other places, I think it's railway stations and things like that too, you have to wear a mask, which to me seems bizarre, Martin, since we're just about coming out of the pandemic. So certainly the death numbers are nothing like what they were at the height, and also, even though the lockdown has been being released, there hasn't been a second spike, certainly so far. So why is it that something like this, a massive decision which we've seen in authoritarian China in the past but never here, why is it happening just as the virus seems to be disappearing?
Well, you better ask Matt Hancock and the government. But I think but what they're hoping is, we probably don't share views on this, Tony, but I think the fact is that if we were going to wear masks, surely we should have been told from the beginning to wear them, and then it's nice and clear and everybody knows what's going on.
Maybe there weren't enough masks.
Well, I think that's the argument that they made. And of course, there weren't enough masks because they hadn't bothered to replace they were saving money and they didn't bother to replace the old masks that they had in storage.
Now, the massively, massively expensive masks are available in your supermarkets, folks. 10 times what they would have been before the pandemic. But anyway, maybe someone's making a few bob out of this. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Henry Widdus. He's a reporter up in Blackburn, works on local papers up there. And he very spiritingly went out this morning in order to try out some of the supermarkets to see, because he's asthmatic, he doesn't want to wear a mask and he refuses to wear a mask, but he wanted to see how he'd get on going in to do some shopping in four different supermarkets with no mask on.
Today is Friday the 24th of July, the first day of mandatory wearing masks in shops. I've got asthma, so I'm going to be trying to go into the Co-op, local Aldi and a spa, all in Blackburn, just see what sort of reaction I get. I've been told my doctor won't give me a note to say that I've got an exemption for having asthma because I don't feel comfortable wearing a mask. I was told to go to Public Health England. From there, I was told to go on the website and see what the exemption information is, and I was not able to find anything useful at all. So I went on the asthma.org website, and they have their own exemption pass, if you like, that you can print out. I don't have a printer, so I've downloaded one as a PDF on my phone. But apparently shops have been given guidance, all the main shops, that they're not to confront shoppers not wearing a mask. So we'll see how it goes. Just on my first stop at the spa in Mill Hill in Blackburn, really friendly from staff. I did feel like I was being stared at when I walked in, so I just said, oh, I've got asthma. And they said, oh, fine, fine, just go in. And then I spoke to another member of staff who I'd spoken to previously before the regulations came in, and she said, yeah, you should really get a doctor's note. So I told her there was no doctor's note that I could get because the NHS has been told not to give out exemption notes. She said, well, I don't know what we could do if, you know, if a police officer comes in and chooses to fine you, then that's nothing to do with us. So I explained that, you know, I had the exemption note as a PDF. And then when I was at the till, I asked, has anyone else been coming in with no masks on? And they said the occasional one, and that they're not asking for proof of exemption. And, you know, they thought it was fine. So overall, a friendly, positive experience. Didn't get any evils from anyone at all. So let's try co-op next, actually. Hi again, just been to the co-op, another positive experience. I did get what could have been the evils from a customer walking out when I was walking in who was wearing a mask, but of course you can't really tell when their face is covered, but their eyes look like they may have been giving me daggers, but I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. I said, yeah, I've got asthma. Is it okay if I come in? And the member of staff was really friendly. He said, of course you can. People have medical conditions. Just come in at any time. You know, we're not going to challenge you at all. And I asked if any other stores are challenging, and she said she thought the Tesco was actually refusing entry to people. There's a Tesco Metro just up the road, so I'm going to try there next, actually. But yeah, overall, a positive experience. I've just been to Tesco, got served fine. It was quite busy in there, Tesco Metro on Livesey Branch Road in Blackburn. I was the only one not wearing a mask. I did get served no problem, although the person on the till wasn't exactly friendly. I was saying, you know, do I need to show anything? He said, well, if you come again next time, you just bring proof of your exemption, or you might have to show a manager a lanyard. So yeah, it doesn't seem like it's been applied, you know, in terms of the shopkeepers at all. And at the co-op, they did say, the member of staff said they'd had official guidance not to confront staff not wearing a mask. So all in all, a positive experience so far. I'm just going to try Aldi last. Just been to Aldi, another positive experience. A member of staff said, yeah, it's fine, yeah, we're not going to challenge you. If someone does ask, just say that you've got asthma. The man at the till wasn't wearing a mask this time. I'd previously spoken to him when he was, and he'd seemed distressed, but they've now got guidance that they don't need to wear masks if they're in the storeroom or on the tills, but they do if they're on the shop floor. Literally everyone in there was wearing a mask. I must have seen about 50 shoppers in there. I was the only one who wasn't wearing one, but no one gave me the evils or anything, I don't think. And you know, I felt comfortable in there not wearing a mask. So all in all, the four shops I visited have been a positive experience. I'd been very worried about going in, like there might have been confrontations from shoppers, and you know, there's a vibe that you sort of pick up in the mainstream media, especially, that, you know, we should all be wearing our masks and doing our civic duty. Seems to be very imbalanced. So I'm very pleased that I had no issues at all going into four major sort of chains to do my food shopping. Right, then, my observations for the July the 24th.
So that's Henry Widdus there, who's been on this programme a couple of times in the past, Martin. But of course, today is the first day. Things might tighten up, mightn't they, over the next week or so?
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens, won't it? When I went to the shop this morning, I did wear a mask. I've been going into that shop every day virtually since the beginning of lockdown. And I imagine if I'd gone out, there were people in there who weren't. I decided I would. And I forgot to bring it out with me now, so if I have to go to the shop later, I certainly won't have one with me.
So what would you do in that situation? Would you try and go in without one?
Well, I think basically, we're all over the place now, aren't we? The messaging has become completely confused. Nobody's sure what they're supposed to be doing. And, you know, basically, when there is an inquiry into this, as there must be, we're going to see Britain's response, or rather the government's response, from the get-go, has been completely confused.
Well, we heard from the Police Federation, Metropolitan Police Federation chair, I think it's Ken Marsh, last week. He's saying that it hasn't been thought through at all, and that the policing of this is absurd. I mean, I think you might even find police refusing to fine people, even if they're called to a shop, because they've got more important things to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, and, you know, the police have also approached they've got to be realistic about what people will and won't do. I mean, like the big rave that was between Bath and Bristol last weekend, which had loads of people complaining. It was so noisy that people could hear it in Bath and hear it in Kingswood. And there were 5,000 people there. And the police basically let them do it because they couldn't, the alternative of, you know, baton charging 5,000 young people, in the middle of an epidemic, if that's what we're worried about, was no alternative. And ultimately the police make operational decisions and, you know, they're realistic about what's achievable. And I think the only reason why we're being told to wear masks now is because there's pressure from business to get the economy moving, get people back into the shops, et cetera, et cetera. So they're trying to have it both ways, encouraging people to go out and do stuff, but you've got to wear a mask while you do it. And it's basically because they basically don't know what they're doing. From the very beginning, they've stumbled around, blundering into one crisis after another. And if you compare what we've done with the successful countries, we have been pretty lackadaisical in every level.
But I keep pointing this out every week, Martin, that it looks to me, I'm not sure if it looks like it to you, that particularly Britain, even more than the US, had this virus circulating well before it was even supposed to exist.
Well, I think these are questions that need to be discussed. Does it come from a biowarfare lab in Wuhan or elsewhere? Is it genuinely natural? And of course, the Pompeo and others are saying, no, it came from a Chinese biowarfare lab and they did it deliberately. Now, of course, we know that the anthrax attacks after 9/11 came from Fort Detrick. And we also know that Fort Detrick in Maryland was looking into coronavirus from bats because they were doing joint studies with people in Wuhan. Now, it can't be a pandemic made of nothing and there isn't any real virus and at the same time a bioweapon. I'm inclined to think that it is a bioweapon. And that's why it cast me. I mean, of course, and in the communist countries like Vietnam, Kerala in southern India, where the communists have been in power since the 1940s, Bulgaria, because it used to be a communist country, they carried out a full biowarfare agency lockdown, and they have basically done very, very well. Whereas in this country, we ignored it until it was too late, which is why we've got thousands of excess deaths.
I mean, you mentioned the Charmy Down party on Saturday night, which obviously did keep some people awake in the local area. Although, I mean, it must admit, I mean, I've been to festivals where there's lots and lots of noise and loads of music going on in very early hours, and you manage to get to sleep. You just kind of, I always find the best thing to do is to, if you listen to it and you're listening to it, and then actually you drop off. You know, there is a whole thing of, well, if you're not used to having music nearby, and you're living in the countryside and it's normally very quiet, you know, that they may just sort of, well, I can't sleep, and get up and go and try and find out what's going on, etc. But I think it's fair to say this is one of the biggest protests against the lockdown that's taken place. I mean, they completely ignored it.
It's hardly a protest. They just wanted to have a rave, didn't they?
Well, I know, but it's saying, look, never mind about all the social distancing rules. We're just going to do this anyway. And to be fair to them, they did have facilities for people who needed welfare help and first aid and that sort of thing actually on site there.
Yeah. I mean, and don't forget, all the pubs and nightclubs are closed. And if you're in your early 20s or late teens and you want to get out there and find somebody from the opposite sex or even the same sex, and the summer's going by, you're quite keen to get out there and do something, aren't you? And it's going to be the police are in an impossible position. And, you know, we will see what comes out of all of this in the longer term. And that means towards the end of the year, we'll have a better idea of whether anything that's been done has been successful.
Well, the BBC say 3,000. I've seen other reports saying 5,000 people attended this rave at Charmy Down. In London, I'm afraid, they only manage hundreds gathering in Hyde Park in the daytime, not just in the night, to protest against wearing masks.
That was a protest. A rave is effectively people having fun, and they're ignoring the rules. But then ravers generally ignore rules anyway. They're taking illegal drugs for a start off, most of them.
And they're actually on private property, which they're supposed to apply for licenses and all sorts of things. The thing is, we've gone into a stage now, haven't you, where you, to set up a sound system in a field and have a dance is now, you've got to get a license to do it. And of course now they're going to say no. So we've seen a complete change in the last 30 or 40 years in this country, from free festivals with thousands of people attending them to now you've got to have a license to do anything.
Yeah, and there's always been tension about it. When the rave scene started getting going in the late 80s, it was all illegal raves.
And then police used the license to close down the Big Green Gathering as well.
Yeah.
And bankrupt it.
Yeah. So in other words, you could argue that people who had basically pushed what eventually happened is the super clubs like Cream in Liverpool and Ministry of Sound and so on took over that niche of the market, much safer in many ways. Because, of course, you know, and I used to go to raves back in that era, and you could be getting into a factory or something like that, where you'd be having the rave, or a warehouse. And basically there's no toilet facilities. You could easily get, if there was a fire, you'd be in real trouble. And, you know, you can't just say, well, let just people do what they want. There are health and safety concerns, especially when people are taking potentially dangerous drugs, which they do at these
events.
Well,
like I say, they have people on hand to help people like that. They have a whole
Some are well organised and some are not. Some are not well organised. I mean, there's been some badly organised ones, which of course, I mean,
Believe in people's right to party?
I'm absolutely in favour of it, but I also don't believe in unnecessarily endangering people and causing annoyance to third parties.
A lot of this goes back to 1993, wasn't it? The Criminal Justice Act. That I think was one of the particular times in history where these illegal raves, or were basically what was happening all over the country, raves were made illegal. And it's nice to see anyway. I think I'm very proud as a Bristolian to see that that's still being protested against.
Well, I mean, they were always illegal. There was no need for the Criminal Justice Act at all. I mean, it just provoked laughter when they said that people are playing music with repetitive beats. It's actually in the law that you can't play music with repetitive beats. That just led to shrieks.
So you're allowed to have one beat?
Yes.
Is that the idea?
I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all. And of course, you know, if you're on private property and all the rest of it, it's very difficult for the police to stop, but it's illegal in any case.
Anyway, at least there was no mask rubbish lying across the field afterwards, because they weren't wearing any masks like we are, most of us are supposed to be doing now. But anyway, let's go to Prime Minister's questions this week, where this whole idea of the face covering, or... See, this is the other thing, isn't it? The word face covering rather than mask. Mask sounds a bit too much like muzzle. That came up at Prime Minister's questions this week.
Ben Lake... Speaker, face coverings will become mandatory on public transport in Wales next Monday. Now, a zero VAT rating has been applied to most PPE since the 1st of May, but at present it does not apply to non-medical face coverings. Will the Prime Minister therefore extend the zero rating to these items so that members of the public, especially those on low incomes, are not financially penalised for following the rules?
Well, Mr. Speaker, as the honourable gentleman knows, and I thank him very much for his question, we have removed VAT from all PPE, including VAT on face masks that, as everybody knows, can protect from infection, and that removed the burden of VAT in care homes, NHS trusts, and for key workers. For homemade face masks, those which meet the PHE guidance will be covered and will continue to be covered by the zero rate, but I'm happy to ask the relevant minister to write to him to clarify the entire position.
Friday is the first anniversary of my right honourable friend becoming Prime Minister.
Ooh, so that is Boris's anniversary today. But the main point they're making there, Martin, is it's okay to have this no VAT on professional masks, but for the rest of us, we're going to have to pay VAT on these.
Well, it's an issue, isn't it? I mean, the mask that I've got at home that I forgot to bring out was given to me on the protest when Colston's statue went down, because some public-spirited young lady had spent all night making hundreds of them and giving them all to the protesters, and that's where I got mine from.
So are you allowed to just sort of pull your T-shirt up over your nose? Does that count?
Well, as you know, we heard earlier from what's going on in Blackburn. I think some people are going to wear them, some people aren't, and there's not really much point getting angry about it.
Well, one person who is smouldering about masks is Dr. Vernon Coleman. We're going to hear more from him this week. I think you can only call him a sit-down comedian. It's a little bit like a better version of the Ronnie Corbett show, because his long stories didn't really seem to go anywhere and they weren't very funny. But Vernon Coleman's made, I think, an excellent job of this week. He classes mask wearers as collaborators.
And so on the 24th of July, we have to start dressing up as bank robbers whenever we go shopping. The shop assistants don't have to wear masks, but the shoppers do. Apparently, according to Boris the Buffoon, the coronavirus can't jump to or from a shop assistant, but can jump to or from a shopper. How clever the coronavirus is to know how to do this. Of course, if a shop assistant pops into a neighbourhood shop, then they have to put a mask on, because then they become a customer, and when they're a customer, they can catch the virus and spread it. Another oddity is that although the coronavirus can infect shoppers, it can't affect people who work in offices. It seems that this very intelligent virus just seems to say to itself, I can infect these people because they're just out shopping, but I mustn't infect these people because they're working. If all this sounds like unscientific gibberish, that's probably because it's totally unscientific gibberish. And how clever, too, for the authorities to know that people in shops must wear masks, but not give their names and addresses, whereas people in pubs must give their names and addresses, but not wear masks. If we weren't fighting a war against the most evil cabal ever put together in the history of mankind, then it would be laughable. And look at the history behind this latest change of heart. Professor Jonathan Van Tam, Deputy Chief Medical Officer, previously announced that there was no need to wear a mask. And Michael Gove, a weedy little British politician who's about as far removed from being a statesman as Bill Gates is from being a doctor, said that the UK government didn't plan to insist that we all wore masks in shops. I bet he feels an idiot now. Because within hours, Boris Johnson, our Führer, backed up by laws which would have been envied by Stalin, Hitler and Attila the Hun, not to mention Vlad the Impaler and Genghis Khan, suddenly decided, seemingly all by himself, that the entire nation should wear masks whenever they ventured into a shop. Everyone knows the disease has almost died out. It'll soon be less of a threat than athlete's foot. If the coronavirus were a pop record, it would be about to slip out of the top 100 and slide into oblivion. Anyone who wears a mask is a spineless and moronic collaborator helping the worst people this world has ever seen. Independent research by a bunch of florists, mark you, not people who look at crop diseases, has shown that mask wearers aren't capable of thinking for themselves. They're not very bright. They're followers, the sort of people who, as children, dreamt of being concentration camp guards. They never do anything or achieve anything. They are saddos, nerds and remainers, invariably devoted to the European Union. Put on a mask and you're bending a knee before Gates, Soros, the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, Blair and the Clintons. One evil, soulless bunch. I've recorded two videos about Gates, by the way. Please watch them if you haven't. The first video is called Just a Little Prick, Part 1. And with startling originality that I'm very proud of, the second video is called Just a Little Prick, Part 2. The mass media invariably describe Bill Gates as a philanthropist, the BBC and The Guardian, both sharing some of the Gates wealth, probably think he should be known as Saint Bill. However, I'm going to try and get the Oxford Dictionary to revise its definition of the word philanthropist. It should read, a philanthropist is an evil crook who has absolutely no interest in the welfare of others, but who uses large donations of money to buy power and control and to make even more money. I'll suggest that synonyms of philanthropist should include slimy single-cell organism usually found at the bottom of filthy ponds. Just remember all that next time you see anyone describing themselves or being described as a philanthropist. The idiots wandering around in their little masks are bending the knee to the toxic Gates. In my view, a being so dangerous and diseased that he should be rammed into a test tube and kept in Madame Tussaud's Chamber of Horrors. Mothers could take their children and point him out as the definition of evil, and they're bending a knee to more candidates for the Chamber of Horrors. Blair, the hideous Clintons, the foul Obama, and the rest of the malignant crew. Oh, and the wretched Boris Johnson, too. The mindless mask wearers are collaborators, and when war ends, you know what happens to collaborators. Most of them are political innocents who voted Remain because they didn't bother to do enough research to know that the EU had been set up by Nazis to enable post-war Germany to control Europe. Finally, I'll leave you with my new mantra. No silly mask, no deadly vaccine, no social distancing. Please learn it, recite it, and share it with the collaborators who seem determined to drag us down with them, but who will fail, because those of you who've seen the light have a monopoly on wisdom, courage, and integrity. Two other small things. First, the channel is growing so fast that YouTube doesn't always manage to send out notifications about new videos. I'm sure this is just a technical hitch. We try to research, write, edit, record, and put out a new one each day at 7 p.m. Though this doesn't leave much time for sleeping and eating, and virtually none for dealing with emails. Second, as you know, we don't accept ads or sponsors or any money for the channel or the website, and I promise that we never will. However big the channel gets or the website gets, there'll never be any outside money involved. And like the BBC, for example, which sold out years ago and can't be trusted to tell the time, this is a genuine non-commercial public service channel. We specialise in the truth, served with a little spice, I hope, and leave bias, prejudice and fake news to the vastly overpaid cretins at the BBC. Thank you for watching An Old Man in a Chair, and thank you for all your support and encouragement. Please copy and share the videos on Twitter and Facebook and BitChute. If you'd like to put on a translation, that would be great. If the videos disappear, then please go to my website, www.vernoncolman.com, to find out where you might be able to find them, or at least to read the transcripts. The transcripts of the banned videos are on the website too. Although it may seem like it at times, please remember that you're not on your own. More and more people are waking up, and I firmly believe that together we will win this fight. If you go to mainstream media, please put on a note asking people to come and look at these videos. Thank you for watching.
So that's A Man in a Chair, Vernon Coleman, Dr. Vernon Coleman. Martin, I saw you smiling at some of the comments, but harumphing at others.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a bit of, I mean, that's a very, very long rant. And if I was in the pub and somebody came up to me and started ranting me like that, I think my eyes would glaze over and I'd perhaps go to the other bar. He's but entitled to his views.
How do you think he does in trying to actually inject a bit of comedy into this?
Well, I think the comedy is not, when he goes on about how Boris is Hitler, which is basically what he's saying, I think that basically exaggerates Boris and underestimates Hitler.
Well, he's saying he's a buffoon. Basically, no, that he was putting on an act as being a buffoon, and actually he is a buffoon.
No, well, I totally agree with that. And of course, people are entitled to their views. But I think the idea that it's all a vast conspiracy by the EU to make us wear masks, it sounds to me...
He didn't say that, did he? Well, he's pointing the finger at Bill Gates, and so am I.
Well, yes, but I mean, the problem is, I'm perfectly willing to criticise Bill Gates, and whether it's... there was no discussion there of bio-warfare, for example. Nothing in there at all.
Well, and you'll probably find there is on some of his videos. Yes, that one was just about masks.
All right, well, anyway, I believe in freedom of speech. He can say whatever he likes. And I can have my own views about all of these things, and I've got a different take on it from him. That's all I'll say.
Okay, so one other thing on COVID-19, a letter in Newcastle paper. This is a prisoner of COVID-19. I'm in my 90s and a resident in a care home. I've been in lockdown for 16 weeks, tested each month. I've been declared COVID-19 negative and fit. I use an exercise bike daily and take other exercise, yet I am still caged up like a wild animal to meet the government edicts. Watching the rest of the world go about their daily business, even going abroad on holiday, I now know what it's like to be in prison. The doors are controlled by an electronic code, so there's no way I can escape. And that's written by name and address supplied in the letters column of a Newcastle paper, or maybe even actually a national paper.
Well, as I understand it, those who have been told to shelter themselves, that is about to be lifted, and they're about to be allowed out, and people are allowed to be allowed in. And
people are not going to be allowed into care homes at all. The only staff, and if you're doing visiting care homes, you will have to be out in the garden. So it's going to be a garden visit, and anyway, only one person at a time, and no coming within 2 meters of your loved one.
All right. Well, as I say, the way in which the British state has approached all of this has been absolutely execrable from the beginning. We are now mopping up and trying to solve further problems which began.
Oh, but hang on, because Alison Pollock, and we reported her on this show, she called it, she's a public health expert from Newcastle University, called it barbaric.
What barbaric?
The idea that you can't hug your loved ones, all this sort of thing, when nobody's actually ill.
Oh, how can you say nobody's actually ill?
Well, if you've got an elderly patient and a young relative, neither of whom are showing any symptoms of COVID-19, and to say that they can't touch each other is barbaric. That's what she's saying.
Okay. Well, listen.
And also that they can't go to funerals and this sort of thing.
Yeah, there's loads of downsides to all of this, and everybody's entitled to their views, as I say. But I think it's very fascinating that Chinese Communist Party, the Vietnamese Communist Party, and the Communist Party that ran Kerala in India, they have got a total of less than 5,000 dead in the whole of their countries. And don't forget, about, you know, one quarter of humanity lives in China.
Do we trust these figures?
I trust them.
Do we trust our own figures?
No, we don't. I don't trust our own figures. I don't trust our own government as far as I could spit.
You do trust Chinese and Vietnam's figures?
Yes, I do. Because they've treated it as a biological warfare attack, which is probably what it is. And it was a biological warfare attack which was designed to bring down the economy of China, and also to allow bailing out of the banking system in 2008.
So if you treat it as a biological warfare attack, your figures can be trusted?
Well, in New Zealand, which is not a communist country, they've had 27 deaths.
But Martin, we keep repeating this little discussion, you and I. Mm. The New Zealanders had no cases when we had possibly millions of cases.
Yes.
And they could prevent the virus, we couldn't.
Yes, and we could have. We locked down. We locked down in my school where I was working on the same day that the Northern Ireland decided to close the schools, because the Republic of Ireland had decided to close the schools. Then Scotland closed the schools, and then Boris decided to close our school a week later. Now, that means we're a week late into lockdown. That week is crucial. And when we do an inquiry, and there will be an inquiry, it will be seen that that week was a crucial week.
At that inquiry, what will probably be said is that we were 3 months late in lockdown, not 1 week late.
Yes, in actual fact, we should have locked down a lot earlier. And, of course, the Israeli Defense Forces were told in November last year that a pandemic was coming out of China. That's according to the Times of Israel and ABC News. Now, that means that the Defense Intelligence Agency in the US knew there was going to be a pandemic in November last year. I asked people to consider, what does that suggest about where this pandemic came from?
Did they know it, or were they just suspecting?
They told the IDF, the Israelis were told, there's going to be a pandemic coming out of China in November. And that people can check this. It's in the Times of Israel.
Well, let's finish the first hour on... well, it's a bit longer than an hour, isn't it? More like 2 hours. But let's finish on some good news, and that is that the coronavirus financial black hole facing Bristol City Council has shrunk. A series of recent announcements from Westminster has eased pressure on City Hall. So the Bristol Mayor, Labour Mayor, allegedly Marvin Rees, has said that we need a lot of help, and now he's getting it. The deficit, or the black hole, has shrunk from 86 million now to only 17.7 million in a couple of weeks. The government is actually now starting to realise it needs to be dishing out money to local authorities, Martin.
Well, insofar as that's happening, it's welcome. But I doubt very much whether they are going to be able to deal with all the knock-on effects. Without a comprehensive plan to reboot the economy, which is pretty much what was in the Labour manifesto, in fact.
So that's £70 million the government had given Bristol City Council after the mayor's made a fuss about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, ultimately, if they don't bail out local government, especially in inner-city areas, it's going to collapse. And there may be four years of Tory government, but a complete meltdown in the inner cities, which could easily happen this summer. You can easily see that young people, if they get arrested for whatever reason, they're all going to be out on the streets. The possibility of rioting like in 2011 or 1981 is definitely there. And that, of course, then leads to knock-on effects on the economy, effects on the pound, and so on.
OK, so let's finish on the rave that you mentioned. 3,000, 5,000, no-one's quite sure how many people were there at Charmy Down on Saturday night, right the way into Sunday. The police decided they couldn't shut it down. And in fact, the BBC on Sunday, their headline read, obviously written by some probably younger journalists, as almost all the BBC online journalists seem to be very young, and very few of the older journalists seem to be still around, had said something, I can't remember the exact headline, but it was saying that the police couldn't stop it. By Monday morning, when the main editor came in, he changed that to illegal rave at RAF site. So he got rid of the thing in the headline about the police not being able to stop the rave. And I thought it would be nice to pay tribute to the ravers by playing a rave tune I can remember from the 1990s. So this, I think, is 1992.